Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. I'm Michelle Grattan. Barnaby Joyce is Deputy Leader of the National Party and Minister for Agriculture. Once he was the Coalition's Senate bad boy, often crossing the floor, but now he's well reined in by the discipline of high office. Things have changed in another way for Mr. Joyce. He's moved to the lower house in the seat of New England. Barnaby Joyce, what differences are you finding being a House of Representatives member to being a senator?
Oh, well, I think the obvious one is when you're in the Senate, it is like talking from a window, almost papal-like, where you express your opinions and your colleagues are beside you and in front of you, and it's quite nice. The House of Representatives is like going out into the footpath after closing time on a Friday night during schoolies week and trying to move the crowd on.
Except without the drinks.
It's obviously more adversarial. It's more tribal. To be honest, the Senate process is a lot more involved than the House of Representatives generally. In the House of Representatives, there can be occasions where you might only go to the chamber for question time during the day and that's it. That's certainly not the case in the Senate. The Senate relies a lot more on committee work. The House of Representatives, you're much more focused on electorate work and broader political issues and just the particular political issues of the day.
You sound as though you miss the more collegial atmosphere of the Senate somewhat.
Well, I suppose distance makes the heart grow fonder, but I think it's important to express the difference between the two, because so that people who are not involved with the game understand. On the other side, the House of Representatives is the main game, and any person who thinks otherwise is having themselves on.
You've now got a lot more pastoral work as a lower house member in your electorate. How do you find that? How demanding is that, especially in a country electorate?
Well, it's not just that. You end up with three jobs. You have one, first and foremost, is your electorate, because if you don't do that one properly, you don't have to worry about any of the others. And then after that, I'm deputy of my party, which means that you almost have a time in your career, you almost have a pastoral guidance section of your job. And as new people come in, and I suppose I've been here for over 8 years, so you do start to know roughly how the show works. And then you've got 4,500 staff members in this thing called your department, which is just like buying a business and buying a new accountancy practice. And you have to work out how that business works and how you can guide that business to a better place. So you really have three jobs working at the same time.
Now, the Nationals were seen to have a big win when Treasurer Joe Hockey rejected the foreign takeover bid for GrainCorp. How important for the party was that victory?
Well, it was very important for regional Australia that the GrainCorp bid did not proceed, or the GrainCorp sale did not proceed, and for a whole range of reasons. First thing I'd like to say is that there were other foreign investment decisions that, although we might have been upset about, we didn't stand in the way of, such as Saputo, which happened in the same week. There was another 130 that happened proximate to that, and they all went through. But this was an issue where you would have had a overseas monopoly owning controlling the East Coast grain trade and also being the end user. And if you just look at one thing, I mean, there's so many things that were wrong about this, but just consider this. I think it's around about 30% of the income stream for ADM comes from US subsidies. So that means US subsidies are strongly connected to US politicians, which are strongly connected to the US farm lobby, who quite obviously want to look after the US farm exports. Now, you're going to have an immense conflict of interest where you have something that relies on the income stream from the agri-political weight of the US being the ones that we rely on to get the best sale for our product in competition against them.
The Coalition and opposition promised to reduce the threshold for the scrutiny of foreign bids for agricultural land. All the state-owned bids are now examined, but not all the non-state-owned bids. Where is all that up to?
Well, we made an election promise, and it was for $15 million for land, and I think it was slightly less than $60 million for agribusiness. I think it was 58, but 58 or 53. But these are issues that are very important enough that we took them to the election, and they don't actually stop deals, because we've seen the Korean Free Trade Agreement, where other countries completely understand this because they have, in fact, vastly more expressed conditions on the control of their own land.
Does this require legislation, though, or is it by regulation? And if so, when will that be put in?
Well, the process will be formalised and hasn't been formalised at this stage, but it is the process we are following in any agreements we are making. So we are acting at this point in time as if it is a formalised process.
And you'd expect that formalised within months?
Well, I don't determine the agenda of the agenda that comes before the House or before Cabinet, but I'm not totally concerned about it because it is the process we are working under at the moment.
Do you think potential foreign investment in agriculture does constitute a problem for this country?
Look, we've always had foreign investment, but we've also got to remember, and I suppose this is taking to a ludicrous extent, but it paints a picture. At one stage, the Aboriginals had foreign investment here as well, and it didn't work out too well for them. We've also, you note that, and I put this in my maiden speech, it's not so much that they can take the land with them. Of course, people can't. But you can get to a point where they control crucial sections and affect our nation's prospects and our nation's future. And I've used the example in my maiden speech that the Romans controlled the Egyptian grain trade, not because they wanted the pyramids or because they were cute for Cleopatra. They wanted to make sure that they had control of a vital supply, and that was white grains. It was not unusual. The British did it later on. One of the reasons that my family initially came to this nation is my forebears that preceded Mary Troy starved to death. Now, they starved to death in a country that was exporting grain. It's just that they weren't getting to eat it. And so these things do have a seminal effect on you, and I don't think that's going to happen in Australia. We're not heading towards a famine, but it always means that crucial issues of supply, you have a role in government to be cautious and to make sure that if you have foreign investment, which you always will have, that it always works in your national interests, and national interests are guided that substantial sections of that should be have a really, we should always have a very close look at it and make sure that it's blocked when it needs to be blocked. And that's what happened with GrainCorp, and that was a good decision.
In general, how do you see the role of the Nationals in the coalition?
Well, the Nationals, ever since William J. McWilliams, have been wandering around the countryside long before there was a Liberal Party. And we have always been happy in our role at being the person beside the person running the show, having influence rather than the direct control and the position of leadership overall. We are happy with our influence. We work from a position of influence because we work for a distinct constituency, which we note will never ever have the majority of numbers, being rural and regional people. But the form of politics we have is either despised or dismissed. But it's been very effective over a very long period of time.
So who's your National Party or country party hero?
Well, like most National Party people, it's Black Jack McEwen. But I think everybody, rolls Black Jack McEwen out. But also Doug Anthony. I think Doug Anthony, all the people who understood the role of how to be a good 2IC.
Just going back to Black Jack, what do you admire about him and how he played his part in those governments?
Well, first of all, his tenure, such a long period of time, where he was happy in his role, his comfort in his role, the dignity in which he carried that role, the respect that he was held, the capacity at times to draw an issue to a close and to express the views of regional Australia so as to change the direction of the government at the time. Now, when you see it, you have to concentrate on the process, because if you actually look at some of the decisions and you see them through the lens of today, you'd say, that was the wrong decision, but it wasn't wrong at the time, such as reevaluation of dollars and how the rural sector interacted in a different economy. But we must also acknowledge that proportionally, rural families were getting a better return, a better portion of the wealth, their standard of living and their terms of trade for the day, when we look at it for the day, were better than they are now.
And he was tough, wasn't he? He knew how to exercise power, and he did it sometimes ruthlessly.
Yes, but you can only be tough if you carry the capacity for people to take you seriously. I mean, any person can stand up and make a sort of tub-thumping speech or something like that, but unless you've actually got the runs on the board and the sort of the personal capital in your political relationships, then it means nothing. And see, that was his art form, is that he was held in higher respect, therefore was able to extract a better deal.
Some people would say that in recent years the Nats have, in fact, lost the capacity to be tough because they haven't really had at the top of the tree the sort of really strong leaders of the McEwen, Anthony, ilk.
Well, I mean, I disagree with that without wanting to revel too much in the things that we have done. Maybe a fault we have is being able to sort of laud our wins, but let's go through a couple of them. The reason we don't have an emissions trading scheme is because of the National Party and the role they took in actually changing the government. I think the reason now that we are moving away from a carbon tax is a progenitor of that, and that's obviously from the National Party. If I look in the past, I'm thinking about the iterations of Qantas at the moment. I remember starting an inquiry of why ALCO, private equity company, shouldn't take over Qantas when everybody thought that was a good idea. Well, that came from the National Party. We were seminal in the debate about why Chinalco shouldn't take over Rio, and that emanated from the National Party. There was a dam that they were going to build over farmland in state politics and from the backbench called Traveston Dam, and completely ridiculous, and everybody said it couldn't be stopped because you were dealing with the Premier in another state. Well, we stopped it. Now, that emanated from the National Party. And on and on and on it goes. Obviously, the National Party's concerns that were also held with many regional Liberals about GrainCorp. Sometimes when people say, oh, the National Party has not as much effect, the question I pose after that is, how close has your examination been?
So you think really the National Party sometimes needs to beat its own drum a bit more?
Well, like, you know, every person and every political party has its qualities that they gain from experience, and generally people especially from the land or from small business, they don't see the worth in telling all the world how successful you've been, because your success is in that you've had an effect, and that's where it should stop. But in politics, of course, you've actually got to tell people how successful you've been.
Now, you mentioned in the past that people in the agricultural sector or the rural sector were relatively better off compared to other parts of the community than is the case now. Mm-hmm. You've recently looked...
And so is Australia, by the way. I mean, if you look at around the turn of around 1900, where we were in global rankings was vastly higher than where we are now. So, I just think these facts will always be put on the table, because you should have a retrospective look at where your strengths lay, as well as a looking into the future as where your strengths may lie.
This week you've launched a white paper on agriculture. Why is that necessary, and what do you expect to come out of it? What's its scope?
Well, the big thing on a global setting, or for Australia, it's really important that we move beyond just sort of a boom-bust mining economy. And we're seeing, with the car manufacturers looking like that, I don't know where they're staying or leaving, but there's certainly a great sense of uncertainty there, that you've got to have a few strings to your bow. If you're mining, you're in a boom-bust cycle. If you say, well, my future is in services, well, you're just one internet click away from your competition in Kuala Lumpur or in Singapore. And we've seen lately that not only that will they be on cheaper wage rates, but they might have a higher standard of education. Therefore, your competition is as immediate as your keyboard. And so that means the service sector is not as certain as it once was. And you will see a lot of accountants, accountants and solicitors and surveyors, a lot of drawers, backroom work can be done in a backroom in another country, but it can be as close to you as your keyboard. So where does our strength lie? Well, one thing we can do that other people can't is we can provide broad, high-quality food in a counter-cyclical environment to the Northern Hemisphere. where we'll have a marketing advantage in such things as high protein white grains such as wheat, that we have the capacity to provide long lines of quality products such as marbled meat from British Genetics, which is in beef, you know. And what you'll find is as people move to the middle class, especially in Southeast Asia, that they will express that move by what they wear and what they eat. They will wear, you know, good quality suits. They will wear good quality ties to differentiate from a more meagre position that they might have occupied in the decades before. And the food that they eat, like any section of the human race, will be different, and they will look for quality. Australia has a capacity to play into that market. If we think we're just going to play into the market of producing food full stop, then I think that is foolish, because you will find places like India will be food exporters, where, you know, because that's another sort of fallacious statement that people think a great population means we'll run out of food. No, a big population means they'll probably produce more food. But your capacity to produce a certain quality product will be limited to the certain geographic and environmental conditions that can do that. And Australia has that advantage. But what we must get right is our capacity to market that product, produce that product, and have the greatest sense of ownership and delivery of that wealth back to the Australian people from that product. And I think that's where the white paper is such a seminal document, not just for the agricultural sector, but for Australia in general.
Now, you've expressed your wish to get the export trade in live cattle and sheep back into a more stable situation. But do you accept that many Australians are legitimately concerned about our animal welfare in this trade? And do you think it's possible to ensure that welfare after animals are sold?
Well, I of course understand that people have concerns. In fact, I would say that if you didn't go to an abattoir and have some sense of an unerring feeling, I've come off the land and I've been in the process of having to destroy animals and slaughter them. And of course, if it doesn't affect you, there's something seriously wrong with you. Accept that the destruction of any animal will make you feel uncomfortable. And that is a human admirable condition. The next thing I would say is we've got to be very careful that we don't start believing that we can manage politics via television, that if we live in Southeast Asia, if we believe we are Southeast Asians, and we are, that's where we live, we must understand the social mores of the place we live in. That means you don't start expressing your concerns via a megaphone. You deal with it quietly. And I'll show you an advantage. We're at the start, only 16% of animals in Indonesia were killed by reason of stunning. Now in excess of 90% is done that. So we have had brought about a great advancement in the humane treatment of animals in how they are slaughtered, as oxymoronic as that statement may sound. We've done that by being engaged in the industry, not being removed from the industry. Now, of course, the live cattle trade has, through the history of our nation, been vital. It came here in one direction and has continued on. So it's not a recent, phenomenon. And our engagement with the Middle East and other places relies on this trade. Now we must grow this trade, we must maintain this trade, and we must also work in the way we have, such as through the ESCAS system, to bring about an advancement. From time to time, unfortunate and sometimes quite barbaric issues will come to our attention, and we must deal with them in isolation and not in a generality. Just as I say, in sort of a more sort of expressive form, if you find someone who is breaking the rules of the road, driving home drunk or driving home erratically, you arrest that person and hold them aside. You don't shut down the highway.
Finally, what's been the most challenging part of being a new minister? What's been the highlight of your time so far, and what's been the most difficult moment so far?
Well, it's very similar. Well, it's not similar. It has a similarity to buying an accountancy practice. You come into the business and you're just trying to understand the rhyme and the rhythm and what's going on, and not try to be a font of all knowledge or some sort of philosophical king. You just try to work out exactly what's going on and then work with your department and the people around you to bring about outcomes. So the challenge at the outset is just getting through the grind of day-to-day issues, which naturally enough take you away from a more sort of, you know, formidable media presence, I suppose I'd say, because a lot of the time you're actually doing your homework back in your office.
Thank you very much for talking with us, Barnaby Joyce. I might note at the end that you're wearing a red tie, not a blue tie, a sign of the distinctive Nationals brand.
Yeah.
That was the Nationals deputy leader, Barnaby Joyce, and that's all for the Conversations Politics podcast for today. I'm Michelle Grattan. Thank you for listening.